This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
People should really question what we're doing in the Caribbean and now the Pacific and just murdering people without charge, without due process.
International human rights attorney Dan Kovalik is in Santa Marta, Colombia, to meet with Colombian President Gustavo Petro and the families of fishermen murdered by U.S. military strikes in the Caribbean.
And then because I was being watched, I was very careful with my words to the SGSU students, and I used a hypothetical conditional to frame what I said. And I said, if you're thinking about doing an encampment at SGSU, then it's not too late.
California college professor Sang-Hee Kil denounces coordinated attacks on faculty opposed to the genocide in Gaza.
At this point, this is primarily about rare earth minerals and big power competition with China. That's what's really going on here. Nigeria is just the proverbial grass that happens to be the turf on which the two big elephants are fighting.
Nigerian author and journalist David Hundeyin says that great power competition for rare earth minerals is behind President Trump's threat to bomb Nigeria to stop Christian genocide. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. As part of his escalating aggression toward Venezuela, Colombia, Cuba, and Brazil, Donald Trump ordered his Treasury Department to sanction Colombian President Gustavo Petro, his wife Veronica Alcocer, his son Nicolas Petro, and Colombian Interior Minister Armando Benedetti for alleged drug trafficking offenses. The Treasury Department announced the sanctions on October 24th, 5 days after Petro accused Trump of murdering Alejandro Carranza in a mid-September U.S. military strike on his small fishing boat in Colombian territorial waters. As of November 6th, the U.S. had murdered 70 alleged drug traffickers by bombing small boats in the Caribbean. International human rights attorney Dan Kovalik is representing President Petro, his inner circle, and the families of the murdered fishermen. He spoke to Pacifica's Ann Garrison from Santa Marta, Colombia, where he's meeting with them.
Dan Kovalik, what are you doing in Colombia?
I'm in Santa Marta. The CELAC EU conference is here, and I'm attending to some legal matters I'm working on. Including with Gustavo Petro and with the families of some of the fishermen who were murdered by the Trump administration.
Ah, okay. Well, first of all, what about the sanctions? Are you there regarding the sanctions on President Petro?
His family, that's a big issue, yes, that I'm here
okay.
for. Yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Well, yeah. So about 2 weeks ago, a little over 2 weeks ago, Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, his wife, one of his sons, and the interior minister were all put on what is known the OFAC list, which is essentially a blacklist of people that essentially economically strangles them. It makes it impossible to do business with the United States, to hold assets in the United States. And even beyond that, because of overcompliance, you know, other entities that even aren't American will be loath to do business with these folks. And so, and it was done clearly, especially given the timing of it, it was clearly done in retaliation for several positions that Petro has taken in the world. One, his very outspoken opposition to the genocide in Gaza. I would say he's become one of the world leaders, you know, one of the, you know, main voices against the genocide in Gaza. Mm-hmm. He made a very fiery speech at the United Nations in New York City about the genocide there. He also made other statements in New York City that I think upset Trump. He actually went out and spoke at a protest, and he told the American soldiers not to follow unjust orders. And he was referring to the possible intervention of Venezuela and the blowing up of these vessels, these little boats in the Caribbean and now the Pacific Ocean. So those are other issues that the Trump administration is upset with him about. And then I would say the last issue, very shortly before he was put on the OFAC list, he announced that he was ending the partnership between Colombia and NATO. Before he took office, the president before had joined NATO as a partner, not a full member, but as a partner.
And, oh, yeah.
And Petro announced that he was going to end that partnership. So between all those things, he got on the wrong side of Trump and Marco Rubio, and they punished him for that.
Yeah, I remember that Trump included Colombia on its list of major drug transit or major illicit drug producing countries this year. But that was going on before under Petro's predecessor.
Many successors. You know. I mean, Colombia, you know, I think it's obviously an overstatement and not fair to Colombia because it's many things. But let's face it, in the minds of Americans, one of the things it's best known for is cocaine. I mean, it's been so for decades, right? This is not a new thing. Right. And it increased a lot under his immediate predecessor, Ivan Duque, and he inherited the increase, but he's been trying to fight the drugs. But in any case, yes. So, and by the way, another former Colombian president, Alvaro Uribe, had actually been on a list, I believe a DEA list, of one of the top drug traffickers in the world. Not only did the U.S. not sanction him, they gave him $10 billion in military assistance at that time. So, of course, this is just complete nonsense.
Yeah, it was when Duque was in power, despite this escalation in the cocaine traffic, that Biden made him a major non-NATO ally, a relationship that Petro just ended.
Yes, exactly. And again, that is the sin that Petro committed, not drug trafficking. And frankly, Petro has spent his entire political career fighting the drug cartels and to great risk at himself, you know, at great risk to himself. So, but again, that's not the issue here, right? As we know, well, you and I talked about this, according to an old RAND Corporation study, hardly a liberal think tank, right? It's a defense contractor. They found it's many times more efficacious to battle drug addiction at home than to try to either intercept drugs or destroy them at their source, like in Colombia. So if Trump and his predecessors really cared about drugs in the American streets, what they would have done is spent a lot more money on drug addiction programs, social programs. Instead, of course, Trump has been cutting all of those. And of course, we also know, let's face it, that both the CIA and the DEA themselves have trafficked in drugs in multiple theaters. So again, the drug thing is just a complete canard to justify U.S. foreign policy aims in the region against Colombia and Venezuela in particular.
How do the sanctions affect President Petro, his family, and his interior minister? And how do they affect the people of Colombia?
Well, I know that their accounts, or at least some of their bank accounts, were frozen. So monies that they had were frozen. The first lady.
Wait a sec. This is even, he said they don't have any accounts or anything to freeze in the U.S.
But some in Colombia were frozen. Because, again, the banks are afraid because they deal with the U.S. banks and the U.S. financial system. They're afraid not to go along with the sanctions, even though they're Colombian.
Wow.
So, well, that's a problem with overcompliance, and that could impact Colombia as well, because he's the president. Kind of everything that he touches, and he touches a lot of things, obviously, as president. Could be fearful of being sanctioned or could end up being sanctioned. You know, one example of what happened to him is he was flying back from the Middle East and he stopped in Cabo Verde and tried to refuel, and a company there would not refuel him because of the sanctions. So he had to fly to Spain, which the government there did refuel him, thank goodness. But meanwhile, his wife, Veronica, is in Europe. She's afraid to try to come home, afraid that a carrier, well, even a French one like Air France, would refuse her on board. So,
wow,
it's a very significant thing.
And so how does it impact the Colombian people?
Well, in a number of different ways. I mean, first of all, it's a bit of a psyop against the Colombian people because obviously for their president to put on the OFAC list is a way to vilify him, to undermine his credibility. And again, we don't know what the economic results will be, but from past history and past experience, we know that the sanctions on individuals like a president can impact the economy. I think it's too early to tell whether that's going to happen here, but I think that that's a very big possibility. And it could end up, you know, and again, what Trump has done could escalate as well. So
well,
it's
how
definitely
would it,
an aggressive move.
How would it impact the economy?
Well, again, because ultimately companies may just decide, well, the president is sanctioned, so I can't deal with him. Well, therefore, maybe I can't deal with the whole country. And, you know, they could suffer disinvestment and divestment because also companies may fear also that others may be put on the list. So, yeah, it could have a cascading impact on Colombia as a whole. And, by the way, there are elections coming up in May, and while Petro isn't running, you know, his party is running a candidate, Ivan Cepeda. Uh-huh. And so I think putting Petro on the list is a way to interfere in that election as well.
Well, he can't run because there's a one-term limit, right?
Right. You can't have two consecutive terms, yes. So he can't run. But the point is, it still could impact his party in the elections, right? So, and I'm sure it's intended to do that.
Okay. Do you have a sense there of how people feel about the sanctions and Trump's overall tone of threat to Colombia and Venezuela?
Yes. Well, first of all, it depends, obviously, on who you ask, like it would in the United States, you know. Uh-huh. I would say, from my anecdotal evidence, just talking to working class people here, cab drivers, people to hotels, they seem mm-hmm. to be very firmly behind Petro and very angry at Trump. And by the way, I'm in the Caribbean. I'm in Santa Marta, which, you know, has a Caribbean coast. And so they're actually feeling the impact of these killings by Trump, you know. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I would say amongst poor people, working class people, people of color, they tend to be pro-Petro and upset at Trump. You know, the wealthier people, I would say, are more supportive of Trump and less supportive of Petro. So that's pretty much how it goes.
Okay, what sort of legal actions are you and President Petro discussing?
Well, one is a lawsuit to challenge the OFAC designation on the basis of constitutional violations. First of all, again, as I mentioned, we believe that some of what provoked Trump to put him on the list were his statements he made at the UN in New York City and on the street in New York City. He therefore has a First Amendment protection. First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is not limited to citizens, right? So I think that's a very good claim we would have in a lawsuit. The other one is a violation of due process. I mean, to destroy someone's economic life without charging them, without putting them on trial, without even giving them a chance to challenge, you know, the allegations that gave rise to this designation. I mean, there's a huge question whether, you know, serious due process violations occurred. So that's one. And then the other is this lawsuit on behalf of the fishermen who were killed, you know, on behalf of their families.
That's for extrajudicial execution or who?
Extrajudicial killing, murder, you know, to put a finer point on it. Yeah, and again, without due process. And again, a lot of these people have nothing to do with drugs. But even if they did, I mean, again, you just can't murder people. There are, you know, so, and there's something called the Federal Tort Claims Act, which would allow a case against the U.S. government for this.
Okay, so actions that the U.S. committed overseas, they can be brought to U.S. courts?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a couple different laws that allow you to do that. But if you want to sue the U.S. government for its conduct, against foreign nationals. The Foreign Tort Claims Act allows that. And while the government and its officials usually have sovereign immunity for the things they did while in office, pursuant to the Foreign Tort Claims Act, the government has waived that immunity. So I think we have a very strong case there. Actually, in about half an hour, I'm going to meet with some of the families about that.
Is there anything else you'd like people to know about this? And is there anything that people can do to support the people of Colombia in this?
Yes, well, I would just say that people need to not trust what they're being told about Gustavo Petro. And they have to understand that, frankly, he represents probably the biggest move towards true democracy in Colombia for many, many years. I've been here many times over the years since 1999. And I got to tell you, I mean, it's a different country now. It feels different. The military is different. It feels like a freer place, you know, and that Petro has been a part of that struggle, you know, and that's very important. And people should really question what we're doing in the Caribbean and now the Pacific and just murdering people without charge, without due process. And again, many whom are just poor people fishing or whatnot. It's really grotesque and people need to resist it. They really need to raise their voices against the U.S. government and say, you know, they don't support this. They oppose the use of military might in this way.
Okay. Dan Kovalik, thank you for speaking to Pacifica.
It is my honor. Thank you very much.
That was international human rights attorney Dan Kovalik speaking from Santa Marta, Colombia, where he's meeting with Colombian President Gustavo Petro and the families of fishermen that the U.S. has murdered in the Caribbean. He spoke to Pacifica's Anne Garrison.
Se quedan mudos, otros tienen memoria para olvidar. Si la violencia es un espejo que se rompe y nuestras lágrimas caídas gritarán, solo recuerda que mi cara tiene un nombre y nunca más se callará.
That was La Santa Cecilia, Nunca Más. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. There has been a series of organized, coordinated attacks on faculty opposed to the genocide in Gaza. At San Jose State University, Professor Sanghee Kill was targeted and charged with organizing an illegal Palestine encampment. She also has been fighting AB 715, a California State Assembly bill meant to censor discussion on Palestine in K-12 schools. She's a member of the 30,000-member California Faculty Association, which is affiliated with the 750,000-member SEIU. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
So, Sang, why don't you talk about this incident that was used by the university to remove you, suspend you, and how that happened?
Yeah, so they're going after me for three particular events and they're saying that I abused my role as the, you know, Students for Justice for Palestine faculty advisor. The irony is that none of the three events that I attended were sponsored or co-sponsored or officially sponsored by Students for Justice for Palestine. So literally, I just showed up to my job and perform my job duties, and they're trying to nail me for a whole host of crimes, about five cluster of crimes. So let me tell you about the events because I think they're pretty significant. So the first one happened when this guy named Blittinger from CSU Long Beach, who had denied a genocide in their local campus paper, was invited to speak by the Jewish Studies Department, co-sponsored by the English Studies Department, History Department, and our head of DEI on campus to talk about a two-state solution and peace. The irony was not beyond me on the fact that this person did not a genocide and wants to talk about a two-state peace solution. So in my due diligence as a scholar activist on campus, which was what I was hired to do, and which for which I was promoted through all ranks, I'm a full professor, I emailed the history department, the head of DEI, as well as the English department to say, I think that you should probably uncouple your co-sponsorship because this guy is not a good egg to talk about the two states peace solution and what's happening to Palestine. He's biased and maybe unhinged. So it was a very professional letter and my language is very clean and everyone refused to de-sponsor and they stood their ground, which is their choice. I was just trying to give them a warning. So I show up to this event and it's no longer in the public library. King Library is uniquely public because it's not only San Jose State University academic public library, but it's also Santa Clara County's public library. So it's one of those unique libraries that's truly, truly public. No signage that the talk has been canceled. Instead, I come up and there's a person there redirecting everybody. And all they said was the talk has been moved to Sweeney Hall. Okay. So we all get shuffled and we go to Sweeney Hall. We arrive to the classroom being flanked by police and them telling us that only enrolled students are allowed to watch this lecture because now it's in a private classroom. And you have to show ID that you're an enrolled student. So I called this an academic ambush because basically they took a public talk and privatized it without any signage, without any discussion, funneled us into a very narrow hallway. You know, there's 60 people there wanting to hear this talk that were denied by a couple handfuls of police who escalated the situation, didn't treat us nicely. I saw Jonathan Roth, a history professor, allegedly assault a student right in front of me. He had also inappropriately touched me many times using his back, pressing it up against my chest before he did that, which I think he did to try to get me to push him off my body and claim that I assaulted him, quite frankly. That's my narrative of why I think he pushed his back into my breast twice. The good thing about him assaulting me in that way, in my opinion, is that I was able to track him. So I saw him walking down the hall, taking out his phone, the person trying to block being filmed, and then him grabbing her arm, twisting it in a painful manner to discipline her. From trying to be soft doxed by him. And it's my understanding that people understood him to be a soft doxer on campus, a known soft doxer.
And what is a soft doxer?
So basically he, you know, I think he uses a social media platform to kind of name and shame people who he thinks are anti-Zionist and conflates that with anti-Semitism, which is the IHRA definition that's adopted by the Trump administration. And his pro-MAGA wrestling corporate head of the Department of Education. So it's a way.
So this is basically saying if you're critical of Israel, you're an anti-Semite.
Yes, that has been Jonathan Roth's claim for many, many, many years, is my understanding. And I have refuted him on that claim for many, many, many years, is my stance. And so, yeah, so I saw this assault and this student was a Palestinian student. So I did Title VI him and I reported him to Title VI. So my understanding—
What is Title VI?
Title VI is the federal protections against religious discrimination.
I see, okay.
So then Jonathan Roth, from my understanding, was immediately placed on paid administrative leave and an investigation was opened. Second incident was on May 8th when an alumni group, mostly Muslim is my understanding, did a sit-in protest on my campus against the genocide. So I showed up for that because I'm gonna show up for anything that's critical of the genocide. And the reason why is because all faculty groups on campus and the administration had refused to call it a genocide. And they still have not called it a genocide. So my local union, CFA-SJSU, has not used the word genocide. my academic senate at SJSU has not used the word genocide, even though the statewide senate has, and all admins on my campus have never used the word genocide to describe what's happening in Gaza. So resounding silence across the board on my campus about genocide. So this alumni group is like, hey, sit in against genocide. Hey, I'm there. They have an open mic. They said anyone can come up and talk. And because I was co-chair of the Palestine Arab Muslim Caucus of the California Faculty Association, which is the union that covers the California State University system, I felt obliged to talk about, you know, my personal opinion on the matter. So I, you know, first criticized time, place, manner, and I said how it impinged on constitutional rights to free speech, which is true. And then I talked about the week that I had supporting and helping the San Francisco State Students Encampment, which was just up the road of the 101 and 280. And what a glorious experience of democracy in action that I got to witness and participate in. And then because I was being watched, I was very careful with my words to the SJSU students. And I used a hypothetical conditional to frame what I said. And I said, if you're thinking about doing an encampment at SJSU, then it's not too late. I was told later that they opened an investigation on me because of that speech, and that they were even going to backdate it to the February 19th Jonathan Roth assaulting the Palestinian student, which is a due process issue, because how am I supposed to collect evidence on myself to defend myself 2 months after when they said I was charged for a backdated event? And then they did something really crazy. So this Marie Fuentes sent me an email saying that I marched the students through the Student Rec Aquatic Center. And I've never been in the Student Rec Aquatic Center in my life. So I don't know where she got her intel. I did a public records access, public records act request to find out. And she did not provide the emails.
Who is she?
I think she was some kind of like a VP for student affairs.
So she was a state college official.
Yes, she was. She was an admin. Yeah. She wasn't. They didn't interview her for the investigation, which I find really interesting. And they didn't call her as a witness, which I find really interesting.
But she provided false accusations against you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So straight up false accusations.
False accusations from top to bottom of the email. So I felt very comfortable replying, I categorically deny your accusations. And that's all I gave him at the time, because it was like so hilarious. Like, wow.
The whole issue of union democracy and the frontal attack on democratic rights, the frontal attack on critics of Israel being accused of being anti-Semitic, and the failure of the national unions, AFT, NEA leadership to launch any kind of national campaign, or SEIU in your case, CFA is affiliated to the SEIU. It seems the SEIU with 750,000 members in California should reach out to all their members that this is an attack on all democratic rights. If they can go after faculty who are SEIU members at the California State University, all educators are threatened, all staff are threatened.
Okay, so David Huerta might not be happy with me, because I did get in his face about this when they had a statewide board meeting. I was able to capture him before he went into the meeting, and I told him my thoughts on SEIU staying neutral on AB 715. And even though AB 715 only relates to K-12 education, and it conflates anti-Zionism criticism with anti-Semitism, it actually greases the skids for that same mechanisms to happen in higher ed. And it's an attack on the whole education system, not just K-12, but also higher ed. So I got in David Huerta's face, because also I'm a border scholar, and I said, what ICE did to you is what AB 715 is gonna do to teachers in the classroom. And he didn't enjoy that critique, but my critique was solid.
And he had been attacked in Los Angeles by ICE. He was in front of a...
kidnapped by ICE.
And the SEIU made a national campaign. There were rallies all over the country.
Exactly. And I promoted his case. I was very pissed. You cannot kidnap our union members for your political convenience. They have a right to protest. They have a right to agitate.
And the SEIU, of course, is tied to the Democratic Party.
Yes.
And the former head of SEIU 2015, which has over 500,000 members, April Verrett is the president of the SEIU, became the president of the SEIU from 2015. And the SEIU has tremendous power in California.
Yes.
750,000 members in California. They could launch a labor party. They could lead a political fight if they wanted to. What is the obstacle?
And that's why it was so important for me, because I was under termination at that point, to get into David Huerta's face and be like, I'm being fired. And it's because of decisions that you're making, like with AB 715 and staying neutral, that allows me to be fired. And I am the canary in the coal mine, basically. And you've helped grease the skids for more of me to come.
And SB 715, why don't you talk about specifically what it does, and also the role of Scott Wiener and the Zionist in California pushing that in the legislature. And Scott Wiener, who says he's for immigrants and is now running for Nancy Pelosi's seat. Who are the people who pushed it?
We call Scott Wiener in some way, shape, or form. So the reason why I have such problems with Scott Wiener was because early on, I saw a letter that he sent to the UC Board of Trustees, basically outlining his case for why TPMs need to be upgraded and weaponized in order to stop this quote-unquote anti-Semitism that was happening on campus, which he equated with the pro-Palestinian movement against.
What are TPMs?
Time, place, manners are these seemingly innocuous policies that say, you know, business and commerce should not be disrupted during operating hours. But what they are actually are policy traps, basically, to kind of capture students, faculty, staff, or even people who just step on campus in order to police their behavior, particularly around free speech.
So it's an administrative scheme in shutting down democratic rights and voices.
Exactly.
The faculty and students. And exactly. San Francisco State, which I was at during the San Francisco State strike, Hayakawa, they tried to ban demonstrations. They tried to prevent the students and the faculty who were on strike actually from taking democratic rights to speak out and organize.
Yeah. But here's the problem with time, place, manner policies. When you have sporting events on campus, people are free to make noise, disrupt, and shut down with their joy, right? But once you have a political protest on campus, then it allows the selective enforcement where people are shut up, possibly brutalized, and possibly silenced.
So this struggle around 715, I know that locals of SEIU 1021 and others opposed it.
Yeah. So let me be clear. My union opposed it. And we are SEIU Local 1983. And we opposed it. And we did our best to pressure David Huerta and his board to also oppose it. But my understanding is that despite our best efforts, they stayed neutral.
Was there a discussion, democratic discussion with the rank and file about this bill, how it would affect workers?
I don't understand the inner workings of SEIU, so I cannot comment on it. I just know the inner workings of my union, and I know that we took a strong stance and we said no to SB 715.
That was San Jose State University professor and CFA SEIU leader Sanghi Kil, who has been fighting illegal termination for allegedly organizing a Palestine encampment against the U.S.-sponsored Israeli genocide. She spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Of all the evil that will have to end.
Yes, we are going, yes, we are. Don't let us stop me.
All right.
It will end.
Well, all right.
Well, all right.
That was Nina Simone, Revolution, Parts 1 and 2. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. David Hundayan is a Nigerian investigative journalist, best-selling author, and founder of West Africa Weekly, an independent pan-African digital news publication focusing on West Africa and the Sahel region. He joined Margaret Kimberly on Black Agenda Radio from Accra, Ghana, to discuss the claim that there is a Muslim genocide against Christians taking place in Nigeria. President Trump and Secretary of War Hegseth vowed to kill, quote, Islamic terrorists, end quote, there, but major power competition and the scramble for rare earth minerals are behind the headline-grabbing narrative.
So we have, in recent weeks, this sudden claim that there is a genocide against Christians, Muslims carrying out massacres against Christians in Nigeria. This had been made by a lot of commentators, a lot of Zionists, for obvious reasons, trying to make the claim that protest against Israel's genocide is nullified because they have to have a genocide somewhere else. So it was pretty obvious why those people were bringing it up. But President Trump has resurrected it. There were some members of Congress, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, and President Trump has jumped in with a social media post on his Truth Social network, quote, if the Nigerian government continues to allow the killing of Christians, the USA will immediately stop all aid and assistance to Nigeria and may very well go into that now disgraced country, guns ablazing, that's in quotes, to completely wipe out the Islamic terrorists who are committing these horrible atrocities. I'm hereby instructing our Department of War to prepare for possible action. If we attack, it will be fast, vicious, and sweet, just like the terrorist thugs attacking our cherished Christians. And then in all caps, warning, the Nigerian government better move fast. And the Secretary of War adds, either the Nigerian government protects Christians or we will kill the Islamic terrorists who are committing these horrible atrocities, unquote. Coming from Trump and company, it's both comical and chilling at the same time. First of all, let's start out with what is happening in Nigeria. I know there are conflicts there. Give our listeners an idea of what is going on that is eliciting even these false claims.
So I guess the most important thing to understand about Nigeria is, in the context of this conversation, is that Nigeria is almost evenly split between Christian and Muslim. Right. So it's almost an even split, which makes it a bit of an oddity on the African continent, because most countries usually have an overwhelming majority of one religion or the other. In Nigeria, it's an almost even split. And the reason that's important to mention is that it gives some context for some of the things that you're about to hear. So in 2019, I was part of a research team that put together a report. The report was called "The Silent Slaughter, Genocide in Nigeria and Implications for the International Community." And my understanding when I worked on that team that produced that report is that we were documenting evidence of genocidal violence in the Middle Belt, targeting people for their ethnicity and for their religion and things like that. So this was presented to the then U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the former U.S. Vice President, Mike Pence. And that report formed the basis for Nigeria's designation as a country of particular concern back in 2020 under Mike Pompeo, before Trump lost the election in November 2020. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up is to create some context for why I think of myself as someone who is qualified to comment on this issue, because I've actually been part of a documentation effort. I've actually been to some of these places, and we actually visually documented these things and put together this report, which had that diplomatic impact that it did. Now, obviously, at the time, maybe I had less of an understanding of the importance of national sovereignty than I do now. So maybe at the time, it seemed like a sensible idea for me to be part of a research team presenting a report about an internal Nigerian issue to a foreign government. Maybe I didn't understand the full implications of what I was doing at the time. But even in that report, it still states quite clearly that, so the premise of the report, one of the premises of the report was that there was a genocide against Christians in Nigeria. However, what the report said was that even though these patterns of large-scale violence and killings affected both Christian and Muslim communities, the reason why the premise of the report was specifically for Christians was that based on the population split between Christians and Muslims in the affected areas, which those areas are typically, you know, more Muslim than Christian, the premise was that the number of Christians who died proportional to their share of the population was more. So that meant that they were being targeted more specifically than Muslims. However, it also does say that overall, more Muslims than Christians actually died in total in this violence, which is why I mentioned at the outset that the population split of Nigeria is important for you to understand the nuances of what is going on here. So in the Middle Belt and the northern part of the country, so the Middle Belt, generally more Christian than Muslim. The North, overwhelmingly Muslim, with some Christian minorities. So in those parts of the country, the northern parts of the country where a lot of this violence is taking place, these are overwhelmingly Muslim-dominated parts of the country. So where you hear that Christians are being targeted, that is not to say that the wider population of Muslims around are somehow having a good time. And Christians specifically are being pinpointed and eliminated while everyone else around them is going on with their lives. No, that is not what is happening at all. Both sets of people are being targeted. Both sets of people, both Christians and Muslims, are dying. The only premise upon which the claim was ever made that there was a Christian genocide was that the rate at which Christians were being killed was greater than the rate at which Muslims were being killed based on their proportional share of the population in those areas. In other words, if the population split between Christians and Muslims in this area is, say, 80 to 20, then if there are 100 deaths, then what would make it fair, quote-unquote, is if for every 80 Muslim deaths, there are 20 Christian deaths. But instead of that, if you have 60 Muslim deaths and 40 Christian deaths, you can then make the claim that Christians are being targeted specially for the fact that they're Christian, and that claim would be credible. But that is not to say that overall Muslims still didn't end up dying more than Christians, because that is exactly what happened. So I find it's a very dangerous narrative that is being, and it's a very dishonest narrative that is being presented now, especially knowing that the vast majority of people, especially in Nigeria, who interact with these headlines, don't know the first thing that they're talking about. They just read headlines and they get an idea in their head and they just run with it. So for example, many people in Nigeria know that I worked on this report and that this report was presented. And they kind of roughly have an idea that this report said there's violence against Christians. So from their point of view, hey, why would this guy who was part of this team that documented this thing now be against someone coming to say that they're going to help the Christians? So did you get paid to turn your back on the Christians? And, you know, all these like funny things that are being suggested. Meanwhile, they've never even read the report. They never even understood what was actually said in the report. The report never claimed that Muslims are fine and Christians alone are being targeted. It never said that. So people like Donald Trump, people like Ted Cruz, people like Eric Prince, and that coterie of, you know, creatures of the metaphorical night who are making these claims now, first of all, are making a very dishonest claim, and they know why they're doing it. Obviously, we know exactly why they're doing it. I don't think we need to go over that all over again. It's visible to the blind and audible to the deaf at this point. This is primarily about rare earth minerals and big power competition with China. That's what's really going on here. Nigeria is just the proverbial grass that happens to be the turf on which the two big elephants are fighting, unfortunately. But putting that aside now, speaking from the point of view of a Nigerian, and for the benefit of any Nigerians who may end up watching this or listening to this, I think it's very important for them to understand that the people who are weaponizing this information do not mean you well. They do not wish you well. They are coming for their extremely selfish purposes, and in their eyes, you're not even an enemy. You're simply a non-factor. It's like you might as well be an ant, right? Nobody hates ants because nobody even thinks about ants. If you're walking and you step on an ant, you don't even notice. That's the mindset that these people have about African lives. So anybody coming to sweet talk you, to tell you, hey, we're, you know, our dear Nigerian Christians, or our precious Nigerian Christians, or, you know, whatever the hell it was that Trump said, that person is being very, very mischievous, and that person is being very disingenuous, very dishonest, and that person is trying to do something terrible to you. And I think it's important that we understand that.
Can you say more about the major power politics and the U.S. Conflict with China and how it connects to Nigeria?
Okay, so basically, rare earth minerals are basically the foundation of all of today's and tomorrow's technology. So we are in, I believe this, they call this the fifth industrial revolution, which is the industrial revolution where the internal combustion engine supposedly is being disrupted, is being replaced. Instead of oil essentially being the thing that keeps the world moving around, we're transitioning into an era where it's things like lithium, where it's things like cobalt and tantalite and manganese and all these things. Those things are called rare earth minerals. Why they're so important is that these are the minerals that form the basic components of all your big batteries, so all your new energy technology of tomorrow, be it your electric vehicles, be it your military technology, be it your AI-enabled robots, whatever it is, all these things are built on stuff that is coming out of the ground. Now, rare earth minerals are not exactly rare. They're actually found everywhere. What makes them so difficult to get hold of, actually, is that the process of refining them is very tedious and it's extremely environmentally disastrous. It is an extremely toxic, extremely hazardous process to get this pile of stones turned into lithium sulfate or lithium carbonate, which is like battery grade lithium that is going to go into your next iPhone or whatever. It's a very environmentally destructive process. And so far, China is the only country which has figured out the technology to actually create a closed loop for refining and making use of rare earth minerals without destroying its environment. That technology is resident exclusively in China. And China did something recently where, as part of its ongoing trade war with the US, it basically closed off its exports of rare earths to the US. So essentially, the US no longer has access to the very things that form the basis of its present and all of its future technology, which it obviously considers to be a major national security threat. So as the U.S. Secretary of Trade, Scott Bessent, I think is his name, said recently, the plan, the American plan, is to replace China in the U.S. Rare earth mineral supply chain within 2 years. And how are they going to do that? First of all, the source of these rare earths, they're going to have to change their source. Previously, everything was coming from China. Nobody asked any questions. Everybody was happy. Now they're going to have to build out their own supply chain. So first, they have to find a new source. Where are rare earths very easily found and where are they plentiful? That's obviously somewhere in Africa. Now, where are you more likely to be able to get away with this sort of extremely dangerous, environmentally hazardous, you know, toxic processes involved in refining these things and getting them out in large quantities without getting bogged down in lawsuits, without having the locals chasing you out because the locals are suitably powerless? It's in Africa. So the goal essentially is to replace China in the US supply chain of rare earths with Africa. And that's not going to benefit Africa in any way. It's going to be a double loss for Africa because the paradigm from the African point of view is not going to change. It's still going to end up being Africa giving up raw materials, you know, maybe with one or two steps of beneficiation this time, but the beneficiation is only domiciled here because of the environmental devastation, which someone else is outsourcing to us. So that's what the goal is. Now, these parts of Nigeria, which have suffered this genocidal violence for just over a decade now, if you remember how I said that both Christians and Muslims have been dying in this violence, it would seem to the uninformed onlooker that these killings, these attacks don't seem to follow any statistical model. Right. If these guys claim to be Islamists, why are they killing Muslims? And not just Muslims, some very conservative Muslims as well. These are very conservative Islamic populations. So why are they killing them? Maybe you can understand if they kill Christians, if they kill African traditional religious adherents, why are they killing Muslims? Large numbers of Muslims. And the answer is, look at a map. Look at the geological map of Nigeria. And it just so happens that these places where these large-scale attacks take place just so happen to track very, very nicely with where they are known to be deposits of these very, very much in demand solid minerals. Their entire villages, their entire places that used to be human settlements, which have been cleared out by violence, which are now basically open pit mines. Nobody knows who owns those mines. Nobody knows who's responsible for it, but things are being dug out of the ground. Things are being taken out and it's happening. It's a thing. So that is what is going on. Whoever is responsible for that, be it the Americans, be it the Chinese, be it whoever it is, the U.S. government has taken a look and has said, right, we want in on that action, because clearly this country called Nigeria, which doesn't take itself very seriously, this country is there for the taking. It's weak. It's, you know, absurdly resource rich. It doesn't respect its own internal sovereignty, has a weak military and weak internal state. So it's just ripe for the taking. Obviously, all these things didn't happen by accident. That weakness wasn't by accident because the U.S. government itself was involved in incubating that weakness. This is a multi-year plan, which has come to fruition. But I guess the reason why there's been this sudden escalation over the past few weeks has been basically a response to actions that have been taken by China. So as I said earlier, it's just unfortunate that Nigeria now finds itself being the grass on which these two elephants are fighting. But however, I do wish that there was a bit more of this geopolitical awareness, specifically in African and in Nigerian circles, so that people would understand that whether it's your religion, whether it's your ethnicity, whatever fantasy you have about maybe having a breakaway republic of your own, all of these things are completely incidental to the actual issue here, which is an issue about U.S. national security interests and rare earth minerals versus what are considered to be China's national security interests and its willingness to engage on different economic terms with Africa. That is what is going on.
That was part of Margaret Kimberly's conversation with Nigerian independent journalist David Hundeyin on Black Agenda Radio. That was Fela Kuti, Colonial Mentality. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Next year is the National Convention of the Teamsters Union, and the campaign for union president is already on. The leadership of Teamsters for a Democratic Union is supporting current president and Trump supporter Sean O'Brien. On Friday, November 7th, at the TDU convention in Chicago, Richard Hooker Jr. of the Philadelphia Teamsters Local 623 spoke out about the issues. The TDU leadership are refusing to allow Hooker, the first black Teamster to run for president, to speak at their convention. He was interviewed by retired Teamster and writer Joe Allen.
I'm with Richard Hooker here outside the TDU convention protesting Sean O'Brien. Richard, would you like to tell the folks tonight why you're running for president, general president of the Teamsters Union?
So there's not just one reason, there are a few reasons. The issue at hand right now is that the Teamsters are isolated from the rest of the labor movement. We are getting attacked on every side by anti-labor administration. And being Teamsters, we should be at the forefront and not a doormat. And also, if you look at our largest contract, there are a lot of things that were promised, a lot of things that were supposed to happen that didn't happen. This has been an extension of more Hoffa rhetoric. And we understand the reason why we say that is because for many, many years, he was under Hoffa. And so he still has some of that residue. And the members are feeling it. Tough talk doesn't work. We were told that we were going to bring UPS to their knees. What happened? The members were brought to their knees. We were told that he stopped automation. That did not happen. Buildings are closing all over this country, with more to come. So, in part, that's the reason why we're running. Also, we need to get rid of this retaliation and retribution. He has an extensive history on coming after people who don't go along with the get along, right? We gotta get rid of that. Open bargaining is a must. It builds transparency, it builds trust. Also, what are we going to do to make sure that our members have resources? Due to automation, locals are going to get hit. What are we going to do about it? We have a plan to make sure our locals can still service and provide support for their members. But last but not least, we have to make sure that we vote. Your vote is private. You don't have to worry about anybody coming after you, telling you that if you vote for a certain individual, that you're going to be trustee or this, that, and the other. Again, it's time that we get rid of that element. So what we're asking for you to do, when you vote, don't be afraid and vote fearless next year. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Richard.
That was Richard Hooker Jr. of Philly Teamsters Local 623 speaking out in Chicago at the Teamsters for a Democratic Union convention. He was also protesting against the TDU leadership's refusal to allow him to speak as a candidate at their convention. He spoke to Joe Allen, the author of Teamsterland. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.